You're listening to the Sermons Podcast from Riverside Christian Church, Disciples of Christ, in Wichita, Kansas. This is the sermon from Sunday, October 17, 2021, on the Gospel of John, chapter 7, verse 53, through chapter 8, verse 11. Today's lector is Nalini Fraser, and the preacher is the Reverend Arthur Stewart.
John 7:53-8:11. Then each of them went home, while Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning, he came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and making her stand before all of them, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They said this to test him, so that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." And once again, he bent down and wrote on the ground. When they heard it, they went away, one by one, beginning with the elders. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus straightened up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, sir." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way, and from now on, do not sin."
So we continue a series on the seven modern deadly sins, and I realized I'd put in the big thing of liturgy just what I was talking about and what it compared to. So today's sermon isn't called entitlement, parenthetically, lust. But what does it mean to lust after something, to lust after someone? So lust is the intense, overwhelming desire for an object or circumstance by any means, moral or immoral, just or unjust. It is related to but different from passion, because passion serves the greater good. Lust serves only the appetite of the luster. It's different from gluttony, because lust is not about overindulgence. Lust is different from avarice or greed, because it is not about acquisition only. Lust objectifies its target, degrades relationship, harms community, centers one's desire in the space where unconditional love should reside, but kind of fills up that space. Lust does not recognize the humanity of the other, if we're talking about lust in the traditional sense. It makes boundaries less important. It obliterates co-equality and mutuality, both of which are necessary for agape, for unconditional love, the love that God knows and shares and calls us to. And whether it is lust for a person or power or money or status, that overwhelming desire can blind us to our place and purpose and space in this world that God so loves. But lust is one of those classic deadly sins. We're doing the modern iterations in the series. I'd prefer we focus on what happens when we don't even desire something we have objectified. We just think we're entitled to it. The trick with the seven modern deadly sins: selfishness, entitlement, materialism, individualism, xenophobia, apathy, and certainty — they all center the self in vitally unhealthy ways. The same can be said, of course, about the classics. Every time I say classics in this, I think about Coke and New Coke. Lust, envy, gluttony, pride, wrath, sloth, and greed — the same can really be said about all sin. All sin, when we do what we should not do or do not do what we should do, when we benefit from harmful systems and institutions and practices, when we make tears in the fabric of our society, of our families, of our relationships, it is about self-displaced. And so our gospel reading today comes from John's gospel, sort of. The story of the woman caught in adultery is a very late insertion into the Gospel of John, perhaps centuries later. Prior to this reading at John 7:52, there's usually an asterisk or those weird brackets that they put. It's just a story that most people know. This isn't from John. It reads more like something out of the Gospel of Luke, but there it is in John. And if you take the story out, John flows. I bet you 10 to 1 Jesus is talking for a really long time about some metaphor. He's just flogging like a... Never mind. I have opinions about John. But it's a good story. And it's one I think we all know. And whether it fits in there or not, we're not worried about the canonical Gospels today, are we? We're worried, it seems, about entitlement. So Jesus is at the temple, and everyone, the text tells us, all the people came to him and he started to teach. And then the Pharisees, the religious elite, those who have it all figured out and want everyone to conform to their view and their understanding and their orthodoxy, sometimes in the best of intentions and sometimes in the worst ways possible. We can be the religious elite in every story, friends. The Pharisees bring a woman who has been caught in adultery right in the middle of all the people. They just kind of toss her down. See, here's the thing about adultery. It takes two people at the minimum to happen. This story reads as if the woman was caught in delecto, which begs the question why only one person is being dragged in front of Jesus. Perhaps we have to understand this story as one, yet again, of power exploiting powerlessness. There should be, well, okay, this woman, but also what about the man? We do assume heteronormativity. Why isn't he there holding up his boxer shorts? Of course, the religious elite who are provoking a crisis, demanding Christ's response, they don't seem too concerned about the human beings in this story. There's no dignity, there's no value, there's no empathy or compassion or kindness towards this woman. They don't even talk to her. The first person who talks to her is Jesus after he deals with all of the people who are overwhelmingly objectifying her. She's really just a thing to be stoned to death. Once they trap Jesus in their lust for power and orthodoxy, they're entitled to kill her, to throw rocks at her until she dies of those wounds, according to the law or to the custom or to both, whatever. And there's not much room for any other consideration. They're positive they have Jesus trapped in this system. They don't even worry about that other person. They don't worry about the man in all of this. They have a capital offense, the judgment on which they are eager to execute. Entitlement is lust on steroids. It relies on objectification and dehumanization, and it turns people into objects, into cogs in a machine. They become interchangeable. They don't have humanity. We don't know this woman's name, her history, or her circumstance. We do not know if this was a committed relationship outside of the means of traditional functional marriage or if this was exploitative in every sense of the word. Her gifts and her graces and her failures and her shortcomings, all of those little Ben-Day dots that look like one color from far away but are reds and yellows and blues and white space, are ignored. We know one thing about her, and that is this. If she were not caught, there are plenty of others who could have been dragged up just as easily. Entitlement is lust turned inside out. I want things for myself so much I will disembody my humanity and my community because I am entitled to whatever self wants in the pursuit of what I believe is mine. And once again, just as in last week's sermon, this is going to be a constant refrain for the next few weeks. Talking about selfishness, talking about entitlement, talking about sin is not the rejection of self, of one's needs and desires and personhood. Just as confronting and dismantling selfishness does not mean the rejection of self, confronting and dismantling entitlement does not mean the rejection of desire. It means right-sizing it within the boundaries of relationship and community and compassion. Lust and entitlement both objectify, and it is the work of the one who objectifies not the one who is objectified, to change. Once again, it is the work of the one who objectifies, not the one who is objectified, to change. Jesus tells us in the Sermon on the Mount that if you look lustfully on a woman, he's talking to men apparently, or to lesbians, or whatever, but if you look lustfully upon another, let's make it more simple, it is better for you to tear out your eye now and suffer than to be thrown in the fires of hell, for you commit adultery in your heart. It is not up to the person after whom you are lusting to dress better or to act differently or to walk under lighted paths with her keys clenched in her fist. We should teach people not to assault until we don't have to teach people how not to be assaulted. But in terms of entitlement, it hurts to be confronted upon. You see, rather than responding to the request, the permission, the blessing upon a brutal public execution of one caught in adultery, Jesus begins to write in the dirt. This is one of the two stories I can think of that imply Jesus was literate. The other one being when he reads from the scrolls in the synagogue in the fourth chapter of Luke. And as he writes, he says, "Let he who is without sin among you cast the first stone." If you would like to make the Catholics in your life laugh, let me add this in. When he said, "Let he who is without sin among you cast the first stone," he got hit in the head with a rock, and he went, "Ah, Mom!" The Bishop of Et Flunder, who is marvelous, she suggests that Jesus used a long stick. And as they're giving reasons for people to throw rocks at this woman and kill her until she dies, she starts writing out Jason, underline, and then she just writes a list of sins with arrows and looks up at them as they continue to do it. And folks start to see all of their dirty laundry bullet-pointed in the dirt, and they start to go. I like a different understanding, and it requires us to know the story of Susanna. And Susanna is an apocryphal story, and I will do it quickly. Susanna is this. Susanna is an upright, just, marvelous woman who is capable of everything, and she is well-loved by her entire community, and two men have decided, they are elders in the community, of course, that she is the object of their lust, of their desire, of their deep-seated need for physical intimacy, and they are going to do it whether she approves of it or not. Because Susanna has agency, she chooses to say no to them, and they decide to rush her, and she raises an alarm. So the two men run off, and it's like they stand against the wall next to the gate as everyone rushes in, and they come in afterwards, and they say, "She screamed because we saw her with her lover. They were under a tree. They were being horrible. She is an adulteress, and you should stone her to death." Because you know what a great way, you know how good it is to be able to keep people from testifying against you? They can't talk if they're dead. But the good Judge Daniel shows up, and he knows Susanna, and she is upright, and he is upright, and he knows something is wrong. And so he pulls apart these two elders, and they talk, and he says, "By the way, when you saw Susanna, and she was with this gentleman that you can't describe, under which tree was she?" And the first man said, "Well, the ash tree." And the second man said, "Oh, the oak tree." And because it's an apocryphal story, what happens is those two elders were killed. And I don't like that part because I think we have to find grace and room and ways to reconcile even with our enemies that would harm us. But the point of the matter is what I believe Jesus simply wrote in the dirt was, "Under which tree?" Under which tree is a reminder to remember our connectedness, our shared humanity, to break our entitlement mentality, our lust for control. Imagine what happens when we trust each other to follow the rules, to return each other to community when the rules are broken, to understand it is not our job nor our responsibility to pass judgment on the people who break the rules. Once again, it is not our responsibility to pass judgment on people who break the rules, but we hold each other together accountable in covenant. So when I was in divinity school at Bright Divinity School at Texas Christian University, there was a reading room that was called the Bright Divinity School Reading Room. It was dedicated space that Bright paid for, and it was called the Bright Divinity School Reading Room. And undergraduates would go in there all the time, and it made me insane. I do note, like, you think, oh, okay, like, he was a little crazy. No, I was nuts, bananas about this. Brian is nodding. He knows what it is. He's been to movies with me when people have unwrapped candy, and I've nearly come out of my skin. So I went to the reference librarian, and I said, I want a badge and a gun. And luckily, I got neither. But confronting undergraduates who just needed a quiet space to study, and to be fair, I would chase out the talkers. I would chase out the texters. I would chase out the sleepers. It's probably a bad thing. I could have made room. It's not like they were taking up every bit of space. I'm not the sheriff of the reading room. I'm not the sheriff of Riverside Christian Church. I'm not the sheriff of the beloved community. I am a person who, if I'm not careful, is going to feel like he is entitled to enforce a behavioral code, an ethical stance, a moral demand on everyone I meet. And here's the deal. I hope that we can agree ethically on a lot. I hope morally we will hold each other to yes and no, right and wrong. I know that communally we have to be able to say, this is how you do not harm me and I do not harm you. This is how you help me and how I help you. And we're going to mess up always. So Jesus writes, under which tree? Jesus writes a compendium of sins. He starts to write, you know, like thief and drawing arrows specifically. And all the people begin to drift. Remember, everyone is there, all the people. Until all the people go, one by one, two by two, four by four. I'm sure some have to say, what does that say? Well, Moisha, it says that 2 days ago when you said you went to the market, we should leave now. For the first time in the text, it is just Jesus and this woman. And for the first time in this text, this woman is addressed. And Jesus says, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? She says, no one, sir. No one, Lord. And he says, neither do I condemn you. Go your way. And from now on, do not sin again. A word on this. Jesus does not say, go and sin no more. That is not what he would say. He might as well say, go and breathe no more. We are human beings and human becomings, and we are swimming in the water of systemic sin. And we're persons who are going to have the best judgment and best values until it's convenient, or we are tired, or the opportunity presents itself. Go and sin no more. Right, that's impossible. He does say, however, do not sin again. And in the context of how she was caught, in the context of what has happened, Jesus does not condemn her, but Jesus calls her out. Jesus does not castigate her, cast her out, make her a martyr, a pariah, or a fool. Jesus simply says, all of this, is this what you want? How do we create space and change and difference from where we are to where we will be? And that perhaps is grace, that lack of condemnation, the insistence that no one is entitled to the objectification and destruction of another, that right relationship requires examination and revision, and the intentional truth-telling that shows we care and do not condemn. What happens if that becomes our deepest desire, what we lust for? You've been listening to another sermon from Riverside Christian Church, Disciples of Christ. Please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, visit us on the web at riversidedisciples.org. Go in peace. Serve the Lord.